WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The website for Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency had promised to provide updates on savings achieved by Valentine's Day, which is now come and gone. The website's changed, saying the information will be out this weekend, but it's already clear widespread job cuts underway across the federal government. ABC's Mary Bruce has more.
The administration first targeting the roughly 200,000 federal employees who have been on the job less than a year. At the Department of Energy, at least 2,000 workers let go. More than 1,000 people fired from Veterans Affairs, and another 1,000 from the CDC.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio traveling from the Munich Security Conference to Israel, where today three more hostages were returned by Hamas. The Justice Department has filed to drop charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams, despite numerous attorneys resigning in protest, saying that dropping the corruption charges amounted to a quid pro quo. This is ABC News. New information about what may have contributed to that deadly collision between a regional passenger jet and Army Black Hawk helicopter last month.
NTSB investigators say they have now confirmed through data the Black Hawk helicopter was flying at an altitude of 278 feet above the 200-foot limit, but they're looking into the possibility the Black Hawk pilots were getting bad data in the cockpit and may have thought that they were lower. NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy.
There may be bad data. We're looking at, were they seeing something different in the cockpit?
Her team has found just before the crash, the American Airlines regional jet drastically tried to increase pitch. Alex Stone, ABC News.
A boy stuck 50 feet below ground in a California mine shaft was freed after what Cal Fire's Nick Salas called a complex operation.
He's super lucky to be alive. He was very appreciative for the assistance in getting him out of that situation.
I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself, surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
The John and Gordy Show.
Go back to an earlier era before the right dominated the national storytelling. You go back to somebody like Frank Capra. He was masterful at telling that story about the little guy. That heroic figure who had nothing but worked hard, looked out for other people, cared about family, and made a better life. And that kind of storytelling has vanished.
Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on 92.7 WMDX. This is your local civic media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Conservation groups are criticizing the Trump administration's new review of all oil, gas, and mining on public lands. Suzanne Potter reports.
New U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum has ordered a 15-day internal review of these sites, which conservation groups warn could be a first step toward altering their boundaries to allow fossil fuel and mineral extraction. And yet, Daniel Hart with the National Parks Conservation Association says this would do little to address the energy emergency recently declared by President Donald Trump.
The timeline from starting a lease sale until oil and gas is pumping and then refined and into the markets is a long time. It would not immediately do anything to lower gas prices.
In the past, Carrizo Plain National Monument on the Central Coast has been eyed for oil and gas development. Other national monuments in California whose boundaries could be reevaluated include the two newest, Chuckwalla and Satitla National Monuments, along with 13 others across the state. Hart says these public lands are crucial for wildlife habitat and recreation, and he points out they pump billions of dollars into the outdoor economy.
They protect both natural and cultural resources. They are a great place for our shared histories, but also the public benefit. They support the outdoor recreation economy, especially in rural states.
Across the U.S., 24 million acres of public land are already leased to oil and gas companies for fossil fuel extraction, with over 12 million acres under active drilling. The NPCA says key monuments that risk losing protections include Devil's Tower in Wyoming and the Dinosaur and Hovensweep National Monuments in Utah. I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Winter weather advisories continue with flurries and snow showers and an inch or two of accumulation with a high in the low 30s. Still some flurries and snow showers tonight, low in the mid-teens. Gradually clearing for tomorrow, but colder, high near 20. It's 24 right now.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, some unusual foods will be available in conjunction with Sharp Literacy in Waukesha. We'll wrap up the show with This Shouldn't Be a Thing. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 11.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, focusing on all things justice in our broadcast this weekend, specifically this major story coming out of Washington, D.C. involving the dismissal. And yes, it did indeed happen in the end. I'll tell you about that in just a moment or so, of the major indictment that has been pending for months against the mayor of New York City, alleging fraud and corruption, all sorts of violations of federal law in connection with his service as mayor, and even before that, when he was a borough president there in New York City. In the wake of the directive from the present Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America to the United States Attorney in Southern District of New York, that U.S. attorney said, no, I'm not doing this, writes an 8-page scathing missive to her boss back at Maine Justice saying, I'm not doing this. And by the way, you're violating the basic rules and principles and procedures by which the Department of Justice and any prosecutors should behave when it comes to prosecuting, investigating cases. You're not doing that. She cites the specific things that Pam Bondi and others have said to establish the ways in which the Department of Justice should be apolitical. She notes along the way that Emile Beauvais has not criticized in any way the manner by which the indictment was gotten, affirms that this is a strong case. It should go to trial, anticipating it would go to trial in front of the judge. His name again is Dale E. Ho, and says in the end that your reasons for dismissing the case are completely wrong, completely inappropriate, and unethical. And she goes on to say that because the law does not support a dismissal and because I'm confident that Mayor Adams has committed the crimes with which he is charged, I cannot agree to seek a dismissal driven by improper consideration. She's talking to, plainly, not only the Attorney General, but Emile Beauvais. As Justice Robert Jackson of the Supreme Court said, she invokes again the statements by him in his writing called The Federal Prosecutor. She said, the prosecutor at his best is one of the most beneficent beneficial forces in our society. When he acts from malice or other motives, he is one of the worst. This authority, she says, is granted by people who really wanted the right thing done, wanted crime eliminated. That animation has been granted by the people of the United States of America pursuant to our traditions. She's invoking history. She's invoking, again, the basic standards by which the Department of Justice has operated for all of its history. She goes on to say, I understand that Mr. Beauvais disagrees, and I am mindful of your recent order reiterating prosecutors' duty to make good faith arguments in support of the executive branch's position. And yes, indeed, one of the things we'll talk about are the many policies that the new attorney general has put in place. Indeed, advocating for and requiring that U.S. attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys, stand up in court and advocate for the policies of the White House. Again, a break from past administrations of all varieties. But she goes on to say, but because I do not see any good faith basis for the proposed position, I cannot make such arguments consistent with my duty of candor. She invokes again New York law. And she goes on to say that in particular, the rationale given by Emile Vauvais, an exchange between a criminal defendant and the Department of Justice, akin once again to this prisoner exchange, to the bout exchange with Russia, is, as explained above in the previous seven pages, a bargain that a prosecutor should not make. The U.S. attorney goes on to say, moreover, dismissing without prejudice and with the express option of again indicting Adams in the future creates obvious ethical problems. By implicitly threatening future prosecution, if Adams' cooperation with enforcing the immigration laws proves unsatisfactory to the department. That's the quid pro quo. That's the thing that the immigration czar is holding over the head of the mayor of New York. If you don't cooperate with us, we can come back and reinitiate this case. That's what the U.S. attorney speaks about in terms of the specter of very bad things happening. That's also the reason, of course, why an awful lot of people are now saying that by virtue of what is happening here, Mayor Adams can no longer be a true and honest and genuine representative of the people of New York. Why? Because now he is beholden to Donald Trump, the White House, and the policies of the White House. Again, putting aside the merits or demerits of those, it is a connection, an attempt to be a marionette, if you will, a puppeteer, if you will, while all of this is going on. And it prompts, in the end, the United States attorney to say not only is she baffled by this decision, but she notes that Emile Vauvais admonished me, she's speaking about herself, to be mindful of my obligations to zealously defend the interests of the United States and to advance good faith arguments on behalf of this administration. Again, she's articulating that with a bit of her tongue in her cheek, because that's not been the proposal. That's not been the mandate of U.S. attorneys. We do things in court on behalf of the people of the United States of America, not on behalf of the administration. Those things may or may not be synonymous, but the focus should always be on justice on behalf of the people of the nation. The U.S. attorney concludes her letter by saying, I hope you share my view that soliciting and considering the concerns of the U.S. attorney overseeing the case serves rather than hinders that goal, and that we can find time to meet. In the event you are unwilling to meet or to reconsider the directive in light of the problems raised by this memorandum from the Deputy Attorney General, I am prepared to offer my resignation. It has been, she says, and continues to be my honor to serve as a prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, Danielle Sassoon, United States Attorney. And she was that until Emile Vauvais receiving this letter, this scathing letter from the U.S. attorney telling him that he's wrong, that he's acting unethically, contrary to what the attorney general has said about what U.S. attorneys should be doing, contrary to our basic ways of thinking about prosecution in America. Emile Vauvais decides to fire back, and he fires back with an 8-page letter. And he says to Ms. Sassoon, in no valid sense, do you uphold the Constitution by disobeying direct orders? How dare you disobey what I'm directing you to do? Implementing the policy of a duly elected president. That's your obligation, he tells her, to implement the policies of the White House. And anyone romanticizing that behavior, he says to her, does a disservice to the nature of this work and the public's perception of our efforts. He wrote that he has now accepted her resignation. No need to meet, no need to come to Washington, D.C. It's all done. You can leave, he says, based on your choice to continue pursuing a politically motivated prosecution despite an express instruction to dismiss this case. He goes on to say, you lost sight of the oath that you took when you started at the Department of Justice. That's a battle. That's a war going on between the Deputy Attorney General and one of the chief federal law enforcement officers, and she resigns in the wake of that. And now the problem not only is the dismissal of this lawsuit, what happens next, but you've got people who likewise, based upon this principal assertion of ethics and concerns about what's going on here, not only does Ms. Sassoon decide not to go ahead with her continued involvement. She resigns out of principle. But several hours later, three other lawyers also are resigning. And they're a part of what's called the public integrity section of Maine Justice. Because what happens, of course, is that now Emile Vauvais, if he can't get the signature of the U.S. attorney who is uncooperative with him, he says, I've got to find somebody else who will sign and file this pleading. And so he comes back to Maine Justice. He says, send the case back here. I'm going to go right down the hallway to the public integrity section, and I'm going to tell them, as he did by all reports late this past week, I'm going to tell them that they are now obliged to sign the paper, sign the motion, sign the request to Judge Ho to dismiss this case without prejudice. Do it, he says, and he leaves the room. And there's discussion among the leadership of the public integrity section about what to do here. Apparently, according to an awful lot of reports, a discussion about whether to resign en masse, just as the U.S. attorney has done, or whether there is some other remedy here. And in the wake of that, again, a number of resignations do indeed happen. The officials who oversaw that public integrity section, named Kevin Driscoll, John Keller, those resignations go forward. In addition to the U.S. attorney's resignation, altogether, when this is all done, in addition to another assistant U.S. attorney back in Manhattan, seven assistant United States attorneys and U.S. attorneys and public integrity trial attorneys resign as a result of this. What happens in the end, and here's the procedure that ultimately gets this to Judge Ho. Frustrated as he is, Emile Vauvais, he's got to get somebody to sign off on this to get this to the judge. Finally, a person named Ed Sullivan, he is a longstanding, great integrity inside the public integrity section. He is planning probably to retire sometime soon. And he says, rather than the entire public integrity section, the entire group of us, rather than all of us resigning en masse and basically shutting this down, let's keep some vestige of public integrity here inside the Department of Justice. He says, I'll do it. I'll fix my name to this, not because he supports this, but this is also an act, frankly, of small heroism here. He does this because he wants public integrity inside the Department of Justice to remain. He signs off on it, along with the acting head of the criminal division. And interestingly, Emile Vauvais himself also signs off on this. It's not a long pleading. There are an awful lot of representations in this petition to Judge Ho that is then filed late this past week in the district court there in the District of Columbia, all about what Emile Vauvais wants to have done, not what the interests of justice command, not what the rules command, but Emile Vauvais, what the deputy attorney general wants to have happen here. That's the premise upon which the pleading is written. And so that gets filed. And that brings us up to date, because now it means that on the docket of this case, when in addition to an awful lot of attorneys previously involved in this case from the public integrity section, including an additional assistant U.S. attorney named Hagen Scotton. You may have heard about this as well. He writes a note also to Emile Vauvais and to the attorney general. He says, maybe you're going to find a fool, maybe you're going to find a coward to do this, but it's not going to be me. Strong words from an assistant U.S. attorney to a deputy attorney general to an attorney general about finding somebody either a fool or a coward to do this, but it's not going to be me. Altogether, seven people, various offices of the Department of Justice have said, nope, cannot do this ethically, and for that reason, I'm going to resign. And that gets us then to the next step by Judge Ho, which we'll talk about more right after this and as Amicus Law Review continues.
This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
Hey, it's family time at Chula Vista with the right kind of fun for everyone. Wisconsin's most complete resort experience has everything you want. Fine-tuned for 70 years by four generations of the Kaminsky family, Chula Vista can be easygoing with colorful scenic river walks, a rejuvenating spa visit, relaxing at outdoor fire pits,
Or you can go all out in 80,000 square feet of indoor water park and outdoors with cross-country skiing, sledding, and snowshoeing. Dining comes any way you like it, from pizza to Wisconsin's number one ranked steakhouse. More than 600 guest rooms to choose from with $10 million in updates. Chula Vista, everything you've been wanting, all right here on site. Check it out at ChulaVistaResort.com.
Discover Chula's Winter Wonderland. Miles of freshly groomed trails, skiing, sledding, snowshoeing. Check out bonus gift cards at ChulaVistaResort.com.
A voice for Madison. Real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, inviting you again to be a part of our discussion this weekend at 855-752-4842, joined by my terrific producer, Max. Together, we're inviting your questions and comments, observations, inquiries about the subject matters on our syllabus, principally this major issue involving our United States Department of Justice and the fight. Not just a skirmish, it's an all-out battle between prosecutors, who are the line prosecutors doing the work in the federal courts in America, and the new leadership at the Department of Justice, including Emile Beauvais, a name you should get familiar with, and also, of course, Pam Bondi, the Attorney General. We'll talk more about what she has done also in recent days. She has got a headache on her hands here, to mix metaphors a bit. She has got a major problem here when it comes now to the future of not only the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, but also her own Justice Department there and around the country. She has, as some people say, some explaining to do more immediately, probably. Judge Ho, before whom this matter is now pending, he's now got a decision to make. Does he dismiss this case without prejudice? Does he do other things? And does he have the ability, the answer is yes, to conduct a hearing on this to try to determine whether or not leave of court should indeed be granted? Is it in the interest of justice to get rid of this case upon this petition, knowing that the facts of this are not premised upon a decision that the law is no longer there, that the underlying allegations are no longer true, but premised upon this notion that it will assist the mayor in these political events and political support of his for immigration policies there in New York? All of that on the possible desk of Judge Ho. He could schedule sometime, maybe as soon as next week, a public hearing. Federal courts are open to the public. A public hearing where he asks the parties, what's going on here? Tell me why it is I should or should not affix my name to this order, dismissing this case without prejudice. In the end, probably because of the limited authority and discretion that judges have when it comes to doing these kinds of things, if all the parties agree to it. We've seen this before in other cases. Probably Judge Ho will sign the order and the case will go away, at least for now. But he will also ask about this without prejudice business. He'll ask about what the plans are to reinitiate, why it is it needs to be dismissed now, but subject to the future resurrection down the road. He'll ask about all of that, and we'll see what he does. That will animate a lot of the news, the rule of law news, in the coming week alone. In the meantime, a couple of footnotes about all of this. Obviously, Department of Justice diminished this weekend as these terrific, apolitical, nonpartisan, not Republicans, not Democrats, prosecutors are no longer there. The public integrity section, also one of the core units of the Department of Justice, when the leadership of it and major players inside that unit are no longer there, we are all diminished. Now, those places can be refurbished, they can be filled again by others, but you lose an awful lot of experience and insight and perspective and just basically capacity. The U.S. attorney herself, she's an interim U.S. attorney, has a lot of experience there. The assistant U.S. attorney, who also wrote this poison pen letter to the attorney general about finding a fool or a coward. Also, any loss like this is significant. And so while the Trump administration, yes, indeed, it is the Trump administration that plainly is calling these shots, again, inappropriately, while Pam Bondi and U.S. attorneys can fill these spots, we are diminished even in the departure of those attorneys. I would offer that no less significantly, were diminished in the plain abrogation of this longstanding non-relationship between the White House and the Department of Justice. One of the things that we'll talk about in connection with the changes made recently by this attorney general and by the White House are the fact that the Trump administration has issued an order, again, among many other things related to its relationship with the Department of Justice. It largely reflects some of the guidance given during the first term of Donald Trump. But there are some more clearly identified ways in which communications can indeed happen. And the upshot of this new policy is that indeed the president and others in the White House can talk about specific cases. Significant that in the post-Watergate era, as we've talked about at great length on this broadcast, the White House and the Justice Department have tried to maintain this very strong arm's length relationship, clear lines of separation to do what? To prevent the president and his aides from influencing sensitive cases, frankly, any cases. They can make decisions about policy, generally emphasis on tax or antitrust or environment, all kinds of things out there, but should not be influencing specific cases. Well, the White House counsel has now made clear that the president, vice president, and their counsels may ask and may engage in communications about specific criminal and civil investigations. Highly likely that that happened here. And this is one of the eroding of those guardrails we've talked about a lot. Now, Donald Trump, when asked about this very recently, has said, "I know nothing about this case. I know nothing about how this is going forward." That's his statement to America. That's his statement to his own staff and to the Department of Justice generally. It is appropriate to wonder whether that is accurate or simply a way of shielding himself from the kind of political firestorm that is coming in the wake of all of this. Undeniably, an eroding of guidelines and of guardrails when it comes to communications. Here, you've got a White House telling the Department of Justice to dismiss this case. Why? Because of political reasons, immigration reasons in particular. We also want to keep the mayor of New York under our thumb. And that's the other big takeaway from this going forward. An awful lot of calls now, as I said before, for the mayor to resign. You might think, well, gee, he's been under indictment for a while. Why didn't those calls come? They did before. But now you've got this special overlay that even as the case may next week and the weeks ahead be dismissed, it's still hanging over Eric Adams because it's dismissed without prejudice. And if indeed, as the immigration czar said on Fox News just this past week, if indeed Eric Adams doesn't play along with this administration, the czar will be back, he said, in Eric Adams' office to say what's going on here, and implicitly suggested that the prosecution will be resurrected and revived in such a way that Eric Adams will once again be under criminal prosecution. That's exactly the kind of thing that the people of New York, New York State, the United States of America should not have when it comes to our public servants. All of this, a degradation of the standards and practices of the Department of Justice, all of this happening in the first days of the Bondi administration, an awful lot of things to look to when it comes to how and why Emil Bovet himself, a former assistant U.S. attorney, someone who was at the time of the January 6th events, was outraged by what was happening, the insurrectionists, has plainly now become, inside the Department of Justice, a political actor who is doing exactly what the White House wants him to do, but not without the attention of other people, non-political, apolitical, non-partisan people in the Department of Justice who are leaving the department rather than to continue to serve in an agency and administration that plainly has given up, at least in this respect, when it comes to the integrity of decisions to prosecute and here not to prosecute as well. More of that story plainly coming up this coming week, and that will be principally now in the arena, in the courtroom of Judge Ho in the District of Columbia. We'll continue to focus on that in addition to the impacts of this change in policy coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice and the White House, having to do with arm's length relationships. More about things coming out of the Department of Justice when Amicus Law Review continues.
new choice. Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The website for Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency had promised to provide updates on savings achieved by Valentine's Day, which is now come and gone. The website's changed, saying the information will be out this weekend, but it's already clear widespread job cuts underway across the federal government. ABC's Mary Bruce has more.
The administration first targeting the roughly 200,000 federal employees who have been on the job less than a year. At the Department of Energy, at least 2,000 workers let go. More than 1,000 people fired from Veterans Affairs, and another 1,000 from the CDC.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio traveling from the Munich Security Conference to Israel, where today three more hostages were returned by Hamas. The Justice Department has filed to drop charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams, despite numerous attorneys resigning in protest, saying that dropping the corruption charges amounted to a quid pro quo. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
It's Dame time at the All-Star Game. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Damian Lillard represents the Milwaukee Bucks this weekend at the NBA All-Star Game. It's poignant for Lillard, who remembers when his father took him and his brother to the All-Star Game events back in 2000 when the game was played in his hometown of Oakland, California, and he was just 9 years old.
We went to jam session every day. You know, didn't go to school, me and my brother. They had, like, this three-point competition. So it was just, a great week. You know, a lot of memories. Vince Carter won that dunk contest. You know, a lot of my favorite players I grew up watching played in that All-Star game. Great experience. So now to be 25 years later and this being my ninth All-Star game and kind of back in front of that hometown crowd, you know, it's definitely a special moment.
Damian Lillard will compete in the three-point contest. That gets started at 7 o'clock tonight. The All-Star game is tomorrow night. Coverage on TNT. College basketball. The Wisconsin Badgers in Indiana today against number 7th-ranked Purdue. We'll have a recap after the game coming up. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Winter weather advisories continue with flurries and snow showers and an inch or two of accumulation with a high in the low 30s. Still some flurries and snow showers tonight, low in the mid-teens. Gradually clearing for tomorrow, but colder, high near 20. It's 24 right now.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. While attacks on democracy norms ensue in Washington, state legislatures have also been busy. We have updates from Utah, Kansas, Indiana, and the contested North Carolina Supreme Court race. Voting Rights Lab reports that the Utah House is considering HB 300, which forces mail-in ballot users to deliver their ballot not by mail, but by hand to an official polling place where an ID can be presented. The elderly, disabled, and other voters for whom returning by mail is their only option would need to seek special permission. HB 332 would withdraw Utah from the Cooperative Electronic Registration Data Center, the subject of far-right conspiracy theories. The Kansas Senate passed SB 4, which requires receipt of mail-in ballots by 7 p.m. Election Day to count, rather than the current 3 days after. An Indiana Senate committee advanced SB 284, shortening early in-person voting from 28 days to 14 days, ending at noon the day before Election Day. The full Senate passed SB 10, ending use of school-issued student identification as ID for voting. In North Carolina, a district court judge dismissed a claim by a state Supreme Court candidate that in a race he lost by 734 votes, as many as 65,000 voters were ineligible. A federal appeals court may revisit it. We've linked the Voting Rights Lab tracker at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The John and Gordy Show.
Hey, let's go to the phones. Dick is on the line. You can call us too, 608-879-TALK. Good morning, Dick. What do you got for us this morning?
Well, to the Gaza thing, I mean, his philosophy is this. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's as simple as that.
That's right.
There's no sovereign nation left in this planet.
That's right.
Weekday mornings, 6 till 8, on 92.7 WMDX and the Civic Media app. Pete Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee film critic Matt Miller and Northeast Wisconsin hip-hop artist and musician Matt Harper joins me in studio. We're going to light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast. As always, inviting you to be a part of our discussion. We're going to get to at least one caller in just a moment or so. I want to talk again about things coming out of the Department of Justice, not only this major bombshell, this fight between the now former U.S. attorney in Manhattan and the acting deputy attorney general, going to describe in many ways and define in many ways the Department of Justice going forward. It's a headache, as I said, for Pam Bondi. It is a challenge that she needs now to face when it comes to the future of her own administration of justice, not just when it comes to the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office, but the 92 other U.S. attorneys who are out there. In that connection, one of the things that recently has happened is that all the U.S. attorneys, again, they're all political appointees, almost all of them, have recently been told by the White House that they need to leave. There was a recent email that was sent to all of them saying that it is now time for you to vacate your offices. These are principally the Biden administration U.S. attorneys, telling them that their services are no longer needed. That in and of itself, at the end of every administration, the start of a new one always causes a lot of commotion. The reality is that sooner or later, all of the political appointees do need to leave the office, and so that there can be new appointees made. And that will proceed, obviously, upon, as I said at the outset, this connection between senators who are responsible for identifying candidates within the various districts around the country, making recommendations to the White House about who should be the U.S. attorney in eastern Wisconsin or western Wisconsin or northern Illinois or any of the other many districts around the country. Just this past week, again, fairly unceremoniously, without coordination of something called the Executive Office for United States Attorneys, which normally facilitates the transfer, the movement away of the previous U.S. attorneys from their posts and into the private sector or other assignments, normally handled through the Department of Justice, this time from the White House, all the U.S. attorneys get a notice saying that their services are no longer needed, that they are being terminated immediately. They should leave immediately. And so the Biden administration, United States attorneys, departing. But along the way, of course, that will opens up the prospects for and the anticipation of new U.S. attorneys. And the question that has to be asked of all of them is how they feel about this apparent decision by the Department of Justice, by the White House, to break down that longstanding separation between the White House and the Department of Justice. What happens if, as a U.S. attorney confirmed by the Senate, ultimately in that position to be the chief federal law enforcement officer in your particular district, you get that phone call from the chief of staff of the White House or the vice president or the president saying, I would like you to prosecute or not prosecute this particular case. That, of course, that phone call alone would be contrary to the established principles and processes of every administration, Democrat, Republican, name your president in recent time, name your attorney general of recent times. And always there has been a separation between the White House and the Department of Justice, proved only sometimes in its violation, when indeed that breaking down does in fact happen, and you get outrage because it's contrary to the traditions and standards of the Department of Justice. As U.S. attorneys under this administration, again, the Trump appointees take those positions, questions about what they should anticipate, questions about what they should do if indeed, as happened to the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, they receive one of these phone calls, whether it's from Maine Justice or the White House directly, telling them expressly who to prosecute, who not to prosecute, criminal cases, civil cases. That is contrary to, again, decades, if not more, tradition of the Department of Justice. A few of the things coming out of the Department of Justice, again, in the category of rule of law snapshots just recently. Another dismissal of some significance, again, in the wake of what happened with Emile Beauvais and with Eric Adams just this past week, kind of fell under the radar. But federal prosecutors moved to drop the last remaining efforts to prosecute Donald Trump's two co-defendants. Remember these fellows, Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira? These are the guys who were identified as co-conspirators along with Donald Trump in attempting to obstruct justice. These are the guys at Mar-a-Lago who were trying to figure out ways of not producing those documents, of getting rid of the tapes, the recordings of movements of those documents.
They were joined as co-defendants in that indictment. That indictment, you recall well, was dismissed by a federal district court judge. Her name, Eileen Cannon. The whole thing was pending in front of the 11th Circuit. Again, the Department of Justice dismissed Donald Trump from that case, but did not dismiss the other two by the end of the administration. Well, now the Department of Justice has dismissed those others. Single-page filing. Prosecutors asked the appeals court, the 11th Circuit in Atlanta there, to dismiss the appeal of these two remaining individuals. And again, the court has got to grant authority to do just that. It's going to drop the government's challenge to the continuing appellate proceedings that are pending there in the 11th Circuit. It would formally end that case, the Mar-a-Lago documents case. The only remaining thing that is out there, of course, with the presumed dismissal soon of the two remaining defendants, is the remaining portion of the Jack Smith report. You may recall well that the Department of Justice and the prior Attorney General Merrick Garland decided not to release that report. Why? Because these cases were still pending. Now that they're going away, should we anticipate from Pam Bondi the release of that second portion of that report, the separate section of Jack Smith's report concerning how he and others investigated and prosecute that case, accusing not only the defendant in that case of Donald Trump of taking documents should not have, but also of obstruction of justice along with these other two defendants. More homework, if you will, for Pam Bondi, more small headaches, if you will, to try to figure out what she's going to do. Should release the report, but again, it's within your discretion to do that or not. But nonetheless, the decision by the Department of Justice to release those other defendants now bringing that case to a decisive conclusion. The Attorney General, Pam Bondi, also announcing just this past week that she is filing a lawsuit against the state of New York, the governor there, Kathy Hochul, and the state attorney general, Letitia James. She said, "We're taking steps to protect America. New York has chosen to prioritize illegal aliens over American citizens," our attorney general said. "We sued Illinois," indeed she did, recently, "and New York didn't listen, so now you're next." That's what the attorney general said in a statement that was released to the media after that, right after the lawsuit. Letitia James, the attorney general, said, "Our state laws, including the green light law, protects the rights of all New Yorkers and keeps our communities safe. I'm prepared to defend our laws just as I always have." The receipt, the initiation of this lawsuit provides the governor, Kathy Hochul, also to provide a statement about this. She says in a separate statement that Bondi's news conference announcing this was smoke and mirrors. That's what the governor says. Because the Justice Department's lawsuit, she said, was a routine civil action about a law passed in 2019 that's been upheld by the courts time and again. The governor goes on to say, "There's no way I'm letting federal agents or Elon Musk's shadowy Doge operation get unfettered access to the personal data of any New Yorker in the DMV system, like 16-year-old kids learning to drive and otherwise vulnerable people. We expect Pam Bondi's," the governor went on to say, "we expect Pam Bondi's worthless publicity-driven lawsuit to be a total failure, just like all the others. Let me be clear, New York is not backing down." Again, that in the wake of the initiation of this lawsuit by Pam Bondi, suing New York, suing the top officials there as well. And we've got yet another story sort of coming out of New York, but also the Department of Justice, but also raising some recollections of the past. Just this past week, Trump ally Steve Bannon, we know that he's a senior advisor, probably informally now, but certainly in the first administration, he pled guilty. He pled guilty to a state charge to a fraud-related crime in basically defrauding donors who may have given him some money, did give him some money, in this effort to build a wall along the U.S. southern border. A case that has drawn a lot of controversy. You may recall this case was originally prosecuted by federal authorities who said that he was in violation of federal law. He ultimately pleaded guilty to a count and was in New York when the federal case was the subject of a pardon by the president, basically eliminating that federal case. Now Steve Bannon has pleaded guilty to the state charge, the same kind of thing, pleading guilty to the scheme to defraud these donors for this build a wall a proposal, this build-a-wall scheme, and he's gotten a three-year conditional discharge. We've learned an awful lot about New York law recently. He's going to be on probation for 3 years. It's a conditional discharge, basically says he's got to stay out of trouble to avoid additional punishment, no jail time, could be supervised, but not going to jail, and brings that state offense now, that state charge, to resolution in the wake of the unsuccessful criminal prosecution in the federal court, the pardon by Donald Trump, and the subsequent prosecution by him there in the Manhattan DA's office, that prosecution by Alvin Bragg, the DA there in Manhattan. Lots of things coming out of New York, lots of things coming out of Maine Justice, lots of things going on in the prosecution of cases in America these days. Delighted, as always, to have caller Mark. You're on the phone. Thank you for waiting around. We appreciate, as always, your contributions to our discussion.
Thanks so much, Jim. Yeah, and it strikes me that, you know, Trump is in violation of one of the principles that we, in our Declaration of Independence, you're making judges dependent on his will alone. I might not be quoting that precisely, but, you know, the king had complete power over the judges back in the day, you know, whether somebody should be charged or not, or, and that, it seems like to me that Trump, with his coordination with the Department of Justice now, will be doing that. And the other question I have is that since Eric Adams violated not only federal law, he violated state law under New York's Constitution, because I actually looked it up. New York's Constitution actually does have the Emoluments Clause in it as well. And could not the state take up prosecution of Eric Adams on those same charges? Because it seems that Adams actually took money from foreign sources, and that's specifically prohibited under New York's Constitution as well as the U.S. Constitution.
All those great, great points, as always, Mark. And again, the great concern again about the exercise of power and authority, right, by our leaders at Maine Justice. Their second point, again, a lot of the discussion going on right now about what happens to Eric Adams in the future. As I indicated, an awful lot of people calling for his resignation. Why? Because now he is going to be, presuming this case is dismissed, and I'm making a bit of a presumption here, but not much, that he is going to be under the thumb of the current president, the current administration, and therefore not able to properly serve independently and exercise discretion independent of the Trump administration. Kathy Hochul also suggesting very implicitly, again, the governor of New York, also is suggesting that she's got some authorities to remove him from that office. And your point is also well made. An awful lot of people pulling out the New York state statutes, the criminal statutes. And again, because this is going on in New York, plainly venue there is appropriate. And the question would be, can you craft charges under New York law that would not be subject plainly to federal prosecution or federal oversight? Can't prosecute those because they're state offenses. Does the DA, does Alvin Bragg initiate some charges here in the wake of the collapse of what appeared to be, according to all sources and all information, public and plainly from the U.S. attorney herself, a very, very strong case where a jury, regardless of its federal or state, could in fact have found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? Does the state now pick that up? Mark, a terrific point to make. And again, lots of questions in a story that plainly is not going to go away anytime soon. Appreciate your comment and question, Mark. As always, are all of our callers at 855-752-4842 being a part of our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review. Promised we would continue as well this focus on all things Department of Justice by talking about these other policies and things that the Biden administration has put in place. We've talked previously about the impact of these decisions, for example, to basically shut down the Civil Rights Division, including no new civil rights cases, no cases involving oversight of our police agencies. We've seen already from our discussion this weekend the impact upon the public integrity section, huge amounts of impacts having to do with our national security issues as well, could weaken our efforts to combat foreign influence. She's dismantling a foreign influence task force, establishing new limitations on protections under the law, all kinds of things going on. We'll talk more about those new policies under the Biden administration as Amicus, a Law Review continues.
Well, Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
My friends swim no matter the season, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. Now, thanks to Skyrizi and clear skin, count me in. With Skyrizi, Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. 3 out of 4 people achieve 90% clear skin at 4 months.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist prescribed biologic in psoriasis, and visit skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. In this, the last segment of our show, talking about all things justice, lots of things Justice Department related. A bit of a programming note for next week as well. We're going to take a look at some things happening beyond Washington, D.C. as well. We're going to talk about this federal judge who recently shut down, at least temporarily, the attack upon our transgender youth established by the policies of the Trump administration. We'll tell you more about what happened just this past week at the pen of a federal judge who's pushing back on the attempts by this administration to limit the rights and prerogatives of transgender youth. The judge is named Brendan Hansen. We'll talk more about that next week. We'll also talk about another aspect of Kathy Hochul's recent work, deciding not to honor the directives of a Texas judge who's asking that a particular medical doctor in New York City be extradited back to Texas to face some charges involving telemedicine. Particularly, this is a medical doctor providing abortion pills, privacy rights being advanced there in New York to residents of Texas. And we'll talk about the intersection between state laws, federal laws, and what Kathy Hochul did just this past week to tell the Texas authorities, including the governor, including the judge there, that she is going to continue to enforce the privacy rights of Americans, including those of the state of New York, is not going to surrender up this medical doctor based upon the allegations and the findings of the Texas judges, the judgment entered there. Lots of interesting things coming up next week as well. As we continue to talk about the Department of Justice this week, lots of things to keep in mind about what Pam Bondi has done. Mentioned right before our break that she's done some things in national security area to arguably weaken our foreign influence in U.S. elections. We've talked a lot about the USAID in our previous broadcast. There's more going on in addition to disbanding this foreign influence task force. She's also shutting down a foreign corporation enforcement unit, which also ensures integrity when it comes to the activities of companies and corporations here in the United States of America. The big one, of course, we've seen a lot of is one of the First Amendments, memorandums, that she issued on her first day in office, 14 of them altogether. One of the first of those are planned efforts to investigate and, yes, indeed, undo some of the legal moves from the Biden administration. And that includes the establishment of what she's calling a weaponization working group. According to what she's indicated here, to review law enforcement actions enacted under the Biden administration for any examples of politicized justice. Now, that was actually made reference to by the U.S. attorney in her departure letter. That is, not only is there no weaponization, there is integrity. Here, the irony cannot be overstated that we've got a new weaponization task force, a working group inside the Department of Justice. The review, according to Pam Bondi, will cover cases brought by former special counsel Jack Smith, on the handling of the classified documents case on the 2020 election case. Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg, we've talked about him, the things he is doing even now. The hush money case that led to that conviction of Donald Trump, which remains in place, that judgment still in place. Case from New York, Letitia James, of course, she won that $454 million civil fraud case against Donald Trump. All of that apparently going to be under the review. Curious in terms of the jurisdiction that the federal government has with respect to any or all of these things. But apparently all of that's going to be the focus of some weaponization working group. She's also going to state in another memorandum here that justice officials, including people at the top, assistant U.S. attorneys, cannot substitute their own political beliefs for the arguments of the Trump administration, the White House, as it articulates those. And if they try, she said, they'll be subject to disciplinary action or termination. Well, the question about whether that's even needed, of course, there should not be the exalting, the placement of individual personal views above legitimate law enforcement positions that are argued, as the U.S. attorney herself did, but shouldn't have to tell assistant U.S. attorneys or anybody inside the Department of Justice that politics will not be animating the things that we do. Indeed, during the course of her hearing, she affirmed just that. Nonetheless, there's a new memorandum out arguing and telling the Department of Justice and all of its employees that it cannot do anything even approaching something that would be viewed as political in nature. Interestingly, she has issued two memorandums that focus on the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion inside the Department of Justice, and indeed in the private sector as well. They stem plainly from the president's own executive orders. You recall these on January 21, the day after he was sworn in, called Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity. Pam Bondi's first memorandum requires all department materials that encouraged or permitted race or sex-based preferences as a method of compliance with federal civil rights laws to be, here it comes, rescinded and replaced by some new guidance, eliminating all that. The second memorandum then directs the Civil Rights Division, such as it is, to investigate and eliminate and penalize illegal DEI preferences, mandates, policies, programs, activities in the private sector and in educational institutions that receive federal funds. In the immigration area, of course, we know that the Attorney General has also directed the Department of Justice to withhold federal funding and pursue enforcement actions against sanctuary cities. Memo cites 8 U.S.C. Section 1373, that's a statute of the federal code, that specifically prohibits, that provides, rather, that state or local jurisdictions may not prohibit or in any way restrict any government entity or official from sending to or receiving from the Immigration and Naturalization Service information regarding the citizenship or immigration status of any individual. Now, that's what the law says. What she is indicating is we're going to hyper-enforce that and identify in particular sanctuary cities. The memo warning that any sanctuary cities that violate the statute will receive a cut in federal funding that's otherwise appropriate. Lots of things going on there inside the United States Department of Justice, as I've said in other settings. She's also quietly disbanded a Department of Justice task force that was targeting Russian oligarchs and the things that they were doing to violate federal criminal laws in our nation. Consistent with what the White House has done, she's also established a Justice Department task force to eradicate what she has called anti-Christian bias within the federal government, something we've talked about before. That is consistent, again, with the White House's own establishment of some new program, some new office, a faith office as well. Many of the things coming out of the Department of Justice these days will continue with more of the articulation of those new policies of the Department of Justice and this administration. As Amicus Law Review continues, join us next week and down the road for those discussions. Have a good week, everybody.
A voice for Madison, real news and great conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
Todd Albaugh. Hey, everybody, join us next time. We'll take a look back at the weekend's headlines and give a preview to the spring primary election on Tuesday. Join us.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
The Dane County Humane Society offers programs for humans of all ages.
Bow wow.
For kids, there's Camp Paw Print, Scout Workshops, After Dark, and the new Camp Wildside. They also offer field trips, birthday parties, wow, service days, and their new Paws and Pages reading program. Learn more at giveshelter.org/education.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. It's tax season, but the IRS is preparing to lay off thousands of probationary workers. Two sources tell the Associated Press that sweeping layoffs are ongoing at a number of government agencies. ABC's Selena Wang has more.
We know that in this first round of layoffs, they're targeting people who were hired by the federal government within the last 1 to 2 years. So this could potentially impact more than 200,000 people. Folks in key roles, for instance, in the Department of Health, Energy, and Homeland Security. And we're also told that they're looking at the military next.
Hamas has released three more hostages to Israel. They had been held by Hamas since October 7th. Secretary of State Marco Rubio arrives in Israel later. The Justice Department has filed to drop corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams even after several prosecutors resigned in protest, saying the decision amounted to a quid pro quo. This is ABC News.